Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 182 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing the comprehensive review series that is ongoing for the emergency medicine shelf exam. And in today's episode, I'll be talking primarily about endocrine emergencies, right? Both the ones that occur in diabetics and the ones that do not occur in diabetics, like essentially like other like non-diabetic emergencies. So the thing is, what if they give you a question about a patient? You know, patient comes in, they tell you that for the last 2 to 3 days, this patient has been having a lot of, you know, nausea and vomiting, has not been able to eat, has been doing, you know, pretty poorly from a clinical perspective. And then they give you some labs and you notice that the person's glucose is like 300 and the person's bicarb is like 5, right? And the person has like a sodium of like 130. What's your diagnosis? Well, I hope you're seeing that this person has got DKA. So this person has got DKA, right? So obviously you want to know how to manage DKA and you want to know how to manage HHNS. And the good thing about these disorders is that for the most part, the management is the same. So I'll probably focus the most on the management of DKA. But basically, the first thing is, how do you establish the diagnosis of DKA, right? So the thing is, many people make this mistake commonly on exams, and the MBME kind of counts on you to make that mistake. Like you see, like in some medical institutions, they teach, oh, you know what? If your glucose is more than 600, it's HHNS. If it's less than blah, 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 it's DKA. I would not use those rules on MBME exams. If I were you, I'd focus more on using the bicarb. If a person has a profoundly depleted bicarb, they have DKA, end of story. If a person's bicarb is normal or just like low normal, think more about HHNS, regardless of the glucose number, right? And you may say, okay, so why do people that have DKA develop an acidosis? Well, the reason they develop the acidosis is because they have usually people that have DKA, they have like an absolute insulin deficiency. Essentially like a type 1 diabetic, right? And if you have an absolute insulin deficiency, then you will not be able to inhibit glucagon, because if you remember from maybe studying for step 1 or something, you remember that the beta cells in the pancreatic islets, they are centrally located, but the alpha cells that produce glucagon are eccentrically located. And once the beta cells secrete insulin, that insulin on its way out from the center of the pancreatic islets, it actually goes ahead and inhibits the production of glucagon from the alpha cells. So the thing is, people that have type 1 diabetes, they have an absolute insulin deficiency. They have no ability to inhibit glucagon. And glucagon is essentially the primary hormone that stimulates the production of ketone bodies. So that's why people that have DKA, you know, because again, they have this absolute insulin deficiency, they tend to be profoundly acidotic. Now, people that have HHNS, right? Again, typically it's a type 2 diabetic. A type 2 diabetic has, for the most part, insulin resistance, not an insulin deficiency, right? So the thing is, they typically have enough insulin around to inhibit the release of glucagon, right? So if they're inhibiting the production of glucagon and those other nasty counter-regulatory hormones, then these people generally tend to not have an acidosis, right? Because again, they've inhibited glucagon enough to where ketone body synthesis is not stimulated. And remember, in a person that has like these, like especially DKA, right, the big thing you want to remember is those ketone bodies, right? It can be like acetoacetate or like beta hydroxybutyrate. And then people that have hyperglycemic emergencies, they generally tend to have pretty elevated glucose, right? So it can cause like almost like a pseudo hyponatremia, where essentially, if you actually do like the correction, you'll notice that, oh, this person's sodium is actually quite normal, right? So for example, the correction factor, let me give you an example here, right? So let's say a person that's in HHNS or something, let's say their glucose is 125, right? Let's say their glucose is 1,000 and let's say their sodium is 128. Let me use 128 as an example, right? That 128 number for their sodium, you really cannot believe it, right? Because again, they have like a hyper or smaller hyponatremia pretty much, right? So how do you do the correction? The correction is basically, at least the way I do it is, you take the number of 100s above 100, right? And multiply that by 1.6 and then add to the sodium number you're given in the question stem. So let's assume, again, let me make up some numbers here. So let's assume the person's sodium is 128, right? That you measure when they're in their diabetic crisis. And then their glucose is like 1,000, right? So the way you would calculate what their normal sodium should eat, like their actual sodium is you take 1.6. So there's 9 100s above 100 if a person's glucose is 1,000, right? So you take 1.6 times 9. If I'm doing my math correct, so 1.6 times 4 is 6.4, and then you double that, that's 12.8, and then you add 1.6 to that, that is 14.4. So if you add 14.4 to 128, this person's glucose, I mean sodium, is like 142.4. So that's kind of like within the normal range. I should probably have used a lower sodium number for my initial sodium, but at least you get the point, right? So that's generally how you calculate what their real sodium is, right? And the thing is, as you treat the DKA or the HHNS, the hyponatremia will kind of correct itself. And then remember that people that are in DKA or HHNS, they may be hyperkalemic per labs, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have adequate amounts of potassium in their bodies. In fact, a commonly tested exam association is that people that are in DKA or HHNS, they may have hyperkalemia on labs, but their total body potassium stores are depleted, right? Those are, again, all high-yield things you want to keep in mind, right? And then you also want to remember that ketosis, right, is not always associated with DKA is not the only cause of ketosis you may see on an image shelf exam, right? The thing is, when you see a person that has ketone bodies, you know, you should also look at it in the context of the rest of the question, because people that are starving, people that are pregnant, people that have like hyperemesis gravidarum, people that are, you know, like big time alcoholics, they can all have ketosis on an MBME exam, right? So you kind of need to watch out for that, right? So don't just say, oh, it's ketone, boom, and then you reflex to DKA or HHNS. You may be wrong if you actually do that, right? So you got to be careful there. Okay, so big thing is, so how do you treat DKA, right? So the thing is, basically, if you want me to summarize it for you, basically give fluids, insulin, and replace electrolytes. Those are like the three big things you need to keep in mind. I mean, there are some more specifics that I'm going to talk about right now, but for the most part, if you organize it this way in your mind, you're probably in good shape, right? So like fluids first, insulin, and then replace electrolytes, right? So what do I mean by fluids first? So typically fluids first, you give like a 2 liter normal saline bolus, okay? And usually, you know, you give like a liter in the first hour, a liter in the second hour. And then the thing is, once you're done giving that, you then switch to giving those people a half normal saline, right? So like 0.45% saline, okay? So your initial fluid bolus of about 2 liters, you give normal saline for that. But after that, you then start giving half normal saline. And one nice tool you can use is you can say, okay, like 20 units per kilogram. I mean, like 20 cc's per kilogram per hour. That can be your target. Although that's kind of high, I mean, typically for me, I would say I probably go like 10 cc's per kilogram per hour, because again, kind of depends on the person's weight, right? So it's just one of those things you need to be mindful of, but I don't really suspect that that's something that'll be tested on a shelf. So, you know, basically big thing, 2 liters of normal saline initially, you give like a liter per hour, and then after that you switch to half normal saline. And there are some numbers you want to keep at the back of your mind before you can initiate insulin therapy. And I'll say probably the biggest one is the potassium, right? If a person is coming in and they're in DKA or HHNS, and your initial potassium is less than 3.3, you cannot start insulin therapy, okay? That's a big number you want to remember. If a person's initial key is less than 3.3, you absolutely cannot start insulin therapy. If the person's initial potassium is between 3.3 and 5.3, you can start insulin therapy, right? But the thing is, the fluids you're giving them, the half normal saline, you do need to add potassium to that fluid solution, right? So basically, the only time that you treat a person in DKA or HHNS and you don't include potassium in their fluids is if their potassium is greater than 5.3. If their K is greater than 5.3, that's fine. You can treat them normally. You don't need to add any potassium to their fluids. But if their potassium is less than 5.3 or greater than 3.3, you always need to adding potassium into the half normal saline you're getting. If it's less than 3.3, you cannot start insulin therapy. If at any time you're treating the patient and you measure their potassium and it's less than 3.3, you stop the insulin therapy you've already instituted. And typically the insulin that's given in a person that's in these diabetic issues, typically you give like you typically give the insulin at the rate of like 0.1 units per kilogram per hour, right? And the thing is, remember, there are many different kinds of insulin. The kind of insulin you use is like insulin regular or regular insulin. Insulin regular is like the rapid acting insulin. Remember, there's like the ultra rapid acting insulins. Those are like your Lispro, Aspart, Glulysine. You can use those, but that's not what is classically used on exams. I would say that the one you really should watch out for is the rapid acting insulin, aka the regular insulin. That's the insulin infusion you give in a person that's in DKA. And then some other key things to keep in mind, right? So, you know, as you're treating the person with DKA, you know, you keep lowering their glucose, lowering it. Once it hits anything from 200 to 250, you do need to add dextrose to their half normal saline infusion they're getting, because the thing is, one relatively common complication of diabetic therapy is those patients can actually develop hypoglycemia from the insulin infusion, right? So once their glucose sort of drops to like the 200 to 250 range, you need to go ahead and add a dextrose to their normal saline solution. To their half normal saline solution. And then in general, right, there's a common question that shows up on tests. Do you give bicarb? In general, there's not much good evidence for bicarb administration in a person that's going through a diabetic emergency. If you read a lot of literature, they say, give sodium bicarb if their pH drop is less than 6.9. But in general, giving sodium bicarb doesn't really have good evidence behind it. And then, also when you hit that 200 to 250 glucose number, right? Especially like in HHNS, right, for example, you do need to, you know, begin subcutaneous insulin, okay? So notice I'm being very specific here. When a person has HHNS and their glucose drops into the 200, 250 range, you can go ahead and initiate a subcutaneous insulin. But for a person that's in DKA, if their glucose drops in the 200 to 250 range, you do need to also make sure that the anion gap is closed, right? So what do I mean by that? Basically, the anion gap has to be 12 or less, so 12 or less, and then their glucose is in that 200 to 250 range before you can then say, okay, let me go ahead and initiate a subcutaneous insulin. And a common exam question that shows up is, when you initiate subcutaneous insulin, can you turn off the insulin like drip, like the insulin infusion? You cannot, right? So the thing is, typically when you start the subcutaneous insulin, you'll keep the, like, let's say you start the sub-Q insulin at 9 a.m., right? You can turn off the insulin infusion at 11 a.m., right? At 11 a.m. or later. So again, you do not turn off the insulin infusion until after like 2 hours after you started the subcutaneous insulin. Again, you may say, oh, Devon, you're being very detailed with this. I promise you this stuff is very high yield to know, right? And then one other thing I should mention here is that I remember that you don't want to also lower a person's glucose too fast, right? So if you're dropping a person's glucose like crazy fast during a DKA, right, that can or HHNS, that can cause cerebral edema, right? That can cause cerebral edema. And then I guess one other thing you also remember, right, it's almost like a general principle. If you correct any hyper disorder too quickly, that can cause like cerebral edema, right? So like if you think about it, like hyponatremia, right? Like from high to low, the brain will blow, right? Kind of the same rule applies with hyperglycemia, right? So if they give you a question about a person, you know, has been treated for DKA or HHNS, and then the person becomes altered, comatose, unresponsive, think about cerebral edema as the cause of their symptoms. And then also please do not forget that there are other things that can cause hyperglycemia, right? Like if a person has like Cushing syndrome, stuff like that, right? Those things can all cause hyperglycemia. And then finally, one thing that your friends at the MBMM require of you is knowing how to differentiate between like three prominent causes of hypoglycemia, right? So if, for example, a person is like injecting insulin, it may be like a medical student that's trying to skip work, or a resident, or, you know, like someone in the healthcare profession, and then they come in with like a hypoglycemic crisis. Obviously, right, under those circumstances, you know, you want to go ahead and, check their insulin, and, I mean, obviously give them glucose first, fix their problem so that they don't die in front of you. But, you know, you can do some testing, right? So you check their insulin levels, they'll be elevated, obviously. But because they're injecting insulin from the pharmacy, right, their C-peptide will be normal, right? Or decreased, right? So that's one thing you want to keep in mind. And then if a person has an insulinoma, right? Obviously, if a person has an insulinoma, they will have, like, increased insulin, but they also have increased C-peptide because the insulin is endogenous, right? It's coming from their own bodies, right? So again, key thing to keep in mind, their insulin C-peptide will be elevated. And then you may get the unusual case of a person that's, you know, trying to overdose on a sulfonylurea, right? If a person is trying to overdose on a sulfonylurea, because remember, sulfonylureas, right, they block that ATP-dependent potassium pump that you find in the pancreatic beta cells. So when they block those things, right, that will cause the cell to depolarize, and then calcium will rush in, and then you'll squirt out a ton of insulin. So people that actually, like, you know, overdose on, like, sulfonylureas, so like gliburide, glipizide, glimepiride, or people that overdose on, like, the meglidinites. Remember, the meglidinites work essentially like the sulfonylureas, but the thing is they're a lot shorter acting, right? So drugs like nateglinide and repaglinide, those can cause a similar toxicity, right? So, you know, they'll have a hypoglycemic crisis. Their insulin will be elevated, but because, again, those drugs are like insulin secretor drugs, like they promote the release of insulin in the body, those people's C-peptide would also be elevated as well. But the key thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is that you do a secretor GOG screen, right? The secretor GOG screen will be positive in a person that's, you know, like overdosing on sulfonylurea, and it'll be negative in a person that has like an insulinoma, okay? So that's how you tell those different conditions apart. Now, one thing I want to go ahead and say is your friends at the MBME, they may give you a question about a person, you know, that has like a history of diabetes, and then they were working out, and then they are found down, blah, blah, blah. Obviously, for those people, right, you want to go ahead and they probably have like a hypoglycemic crisis. You want to go ahead and give those people a 50% like dextrose solution to raise their blood glucose levels. And then after that, you just feed them, right? Because food will, you know, probably give you better elevations in your blood glucose than just D50. But D50 is like your first step in management. If you don't have IV access, right, then one thing you can consider doing is give IM glucagon. IM glucagon can rapidly raise a person's blood glucose levels, right? So if a person is a type 1 diabetic, obviously the only drug they can be using is insulin, right? So, you know, again, for those people, you know, giving glucose is fine, right? But here's one thing you need to be careful of. If a person has like a hypoglycemic crisis as a result of taking a sulfonylurea, again, the initial step in management is the same, right? You know, you give 50% dextrose. But one thing you really do need to be mindful of is that you cannot send those patients home immediately, right? You need to kind of watch them for a day in the emergency room. And typically on the exams, you probably also want to go ahead and give them octreotide because it's kind of different. You know, like a sulfonylurea, right? Like some of them have, you know, pretty long half-life, so they can hang around for long, right? So the person can have like a hypoglycemic episode, and then you treat it, and you're like, oh, great, their glucose has resolved. No, you cannot just wait, right? The thing is, they can have another hypoglycemic episode because the sulfonylurea is still working, right? So typically for those people on emergency medicine shelf exams, you want to consider giving those people octreotide, right? So you give them the octreotide, that can sort of shut down any further insulin release. But again, typically you have to observe those people in the emergency room for about, you know, at least a day. You know, you can maybe admit them overnight to like an observatory unit or something like that. So I think that's all I'm going to say about glucose problems. Although I guess another glucose problem that you could get on your exam can be a person that's in an adrenal crisis, right? So remember that if a person has like an adrenal crisis, they can also have hypoglycemia with that, right? But the thing is, the way you would differentiate that from a diabetic, like hyperglycemic crisis is people that have like an adrenal crisis, they'll, instead of being hyperglycemic, they'll be hypoglycemic. That's one. They actually tend to have hyponatremia, but these people tend to like have like hyper, like you can, maybe let me backtrack here for a second, right? You can already begin to see why the MBME will want to test your ability to recognize, like they will try to trick you by giving you an adrenal crisis question. And it will look an awful lot like a DKA question, right? Because many of the electrolyte abnormalities are the same, with the exception of the glucose, right? So, like, for example, a person that's in DKA, right, has hyperglycemia. A person that is in an adrenal crisis has a hypoglycemia, right? But the thing is, DKA is associated with hyponatremia. Adrenal crisis is associated with hyponatremia. DKA can be associated with, like, hypokalemia or hyperkalemia. Adrenal crisis on your exams will always be associated with hyperkalemia. But DKA is associated with a metabolic acidosis. People with an adrenal crisis also have a metabolic acidosis, right? So again, make sure you can sort of differentiate those things. So you may say, okay, divine, what can trigger an adrenal crisis, right? Like many things, right? So they can give you a question about a person, you know, that has like a long history of like some autoimmune or rheumatologic disease, and they run out of their medication, right? And maybe their medication is like a steroid, right? And then they stop taking it, and right, and that can precipitate our problems. Or it can be a person that it can precipitate like an acute adrenal insufficiency. Or they can give you a question about a person, you know, that, you know, maybe they take steroids for like COPD or something like that, you know, like for like, you know, like severe COPD or like severe asthma. And let's say, you know, they have like a superimposed infection that places them under like big metabolic stress, or they get like some kind of surgery that places them again under big metabolic stress. Those people can, yes, even if they are still taking their steroid dose, if you don't administer like an extra dose of steroids, like a stress dose of steroids, that can trigger an adrenal crisis. Also, they can also give you a person that has a history of like some other autoimmune disease, right? So like Hashimoto's, blah, blah, blah. To essentially tell you that, oh, okay, this person's got Addison's disease that's going on there, right? So these are all things that can cause an adrenal crisis. They can even give you like a person that has, you know, like meningitis from like Neisseria meningitidis, right? And then they tell you that, oh, the person now becomes like persistently hypotensive, hyperkalemic, has a metabolic acidosis, has hyponatremia, has hypoglycemia. Then under those circumstances, you want to think about Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome, right? That's another thing that can classically cause an adrenal crisis on MBM exams, right? And again, people that have an adrenal crisis, they'll have like nausea, vomiting, they'll have all these electrolyte abnormalities, they'll be hypotensive, and they may even have eosinophilia if they give you like a CBC on the exam, right? Remember, steroids cause apoptosis of eosinophils, right? So when you have like an adrenal insufficiency, then obviously you're going to be having less apoptosis of eosinophils, so the person's eosinophil count will actually like, you know, kind of go up. And really the way you can, you know, I mean, typically you treat these people empirically, but if you're like trying to chase after a diagnostic test, the thing is you can measure their morning like cortisol, and then you measure their ACTH at the same time as well. Obviously, if a person has like a low ACTH and a low morning cortisol, then that tells you that they likely have some kind of secondary adrenal insufficiency going on, so like some problem at the level of the anterior pituitary. But on the flip side, right, if the person has like an elevated ACTH and then they have like a low morning cortisol, that tells you that they have a primary adrenal insufficiency because the lack of negative feedback is making the ACTH go up, right? And typically these people may also have like a skin hyperpigmentation, because whenever you have high levels of ACTH, remember that ACTH comes from a compound known as a POMC, like pro-opiomelanocortin, right? So it gives rise to like ACTH and MSH and like beta endorphin, right? So the thing is, that's why it's called pro-opio, right? Beta endorphin is an opioid, melano, that's MSH cortin, that's ACTH, right? So MSH, right? If you're making a ton of ACTH, you'll make a ton of MSH, and that MSH will stimulate the melanocytes, and you have a skin hyperpigmentation, right? So that's like the classic way this stuff presents, right? So for the most part, right? So how do you treat these people? In general, you just give them like, you give them like dextrose, right? You know, you want to fix their hypoglycemic problems, and then you give them hydrocortisone, right? So the thing is, your friends at the MBME, they may try to give you like hydrocortisone as an answer choice, and dexamethasone as an answer choice. In general, you know, go with hydrocortisone. Hydrocortisone is just better, right? Because it gives you both a glucocorticoid and a mineralocorticoid activity, right? So you give hydrocortisone, but if you don't see hydrocortisone as an answer, your next best answer is dexamethasone, okay? So in general, that's how you treat an adrenal crisis. And then another, I guess, key endocrine emergency you want to, you know, be familiar with is like a thyroid storm, right? So thyroid storm, right? It'll be a person that, you know, has like a history of, I don't know, like Graves' disease, or like, I don't know, like... I've kind of talked about this in the first email podcast I make. So like a person that has Graves' disease, not taking their, like skip their medications, or person that gets like, maybe they have like some hyperthyroid disorder, and then they get like contrast for like an imaging procedure, or the person takes amiodarone, right? And then typically these people will present with like diarrhea, they'll present with like massive tachycardia, they may have a fever, but the fever will be like out of, like the tachycardia will be out of proportion to the fever, right? So these people are like febrile, but their hearts are like slaving away. They can have like signs and symptoms of like a high output heart failure, right? So those people obviously have like a white pulse pressure. I want to keep this podcast to, you know, be relatively short, so I'm not gonna necessarily discuss pathophysiology there. And you know, they'll be altered, they may have like AFib. Remember, AFib is the most common arrhythmia in a person that has a hyperthyroid state, right? So in general, you may say, okay, so divine, like how do I treat this person, right? I mean, like first thing, you want to make sure that you know, I mean, typically, you want to treat these things empirically. But if you're chasing after labs, right, this person's TSH will obviously be low, right? Their T4, T3 will be elevated, right? So those are kind of like the big things. The reason their TSH is low is because you have the negative feedback, right? And in general, right, if a person has like a thyroid storm, right, the first thing you do is you give propranolol, right? Propranolol will help with the hyperadrenergic symptoms. And again, you do actually need to follow this order that I'm prescribing here. You can't just like do anything you want, right? Like, you need to start with propranolol. It will treat the hyperadrenergic symptoms. And propranolol also inhibits like the 5' deiodinase that converts T4 to T3. So that will help under those circumstances. And then after that, you then give PTU. Okay, they will try to trick you into giving methimazole. Don't give methimazole, right? The thing is, PTU will inhibit the synthesis of new thyroid hormone. But the thing is, PTU, unlike methimazole, also has the ability to inhibit that peripheral 5' deiodinase, right? So you don't convert T4 to T3. And the patient, you're preventing the production of like a very almost like high grade thyroid hormone, right? So that will help the patient under those circumstances. And then after that, after you give PTU, you wait for an hour, right? You need to wait for an hour. And then after that, you can go ahead and institute Lugol solution, right? You can give Lugol solution. Sometimes they call it SSKI. SSKI is just like a super saturated solution of potassium iodide. So you essentially take advantage of the iod based out phenomenon. You give those people those things, right? And that will like block the further production of a thyroid hormone, right? And then after that, one other thing you can give is you can give hydrocortisone, right? So typically people that have an adrenal crisis, right, thyroid storm, right, they tend to have adrenal insufficiency, so you know, you can help that adrenal insufficiency along by giving that. But another thing you can also that also helps there is that hydrocortisone also has the ability to inhibit that peripheral 5' deiodinase, right? So you don't convert T4 to T3, and then again, that can help with the patient's symptoms. And then on the flip side, right, like on the other end of the spectrum, we have like myxedema coma, again, they can give you a person that has some history of like some other autoimmune disease, because remember, when you have one autoimmune disease, that places you at high risk of having another autoimmune disease, right? So they can give you a person that has a history of like, I don't know, like vitiligo, or like pernicious anemia, or like Addison's disease, right? And then they give you like vitals and labs, and you notice that this person is like profoundly bradycardic. Person's core body temperature is low, so they're like hypothermic. They have like decreased deep tendon reflexes. They have like periorbital edema. They have like generalized non-pedin edema, and they may even be altered. If you see that, right, you definitely want to think about a myxedema coma, right? And the thing is, unlike the labs we had for hyperthyroidism, they'll have slightly different labs, right? So their TSH will be elevated because they have like very low levels of thyroid hormone, right? So they have low levels of thyroid hormone. So there's no negative feedback, right? So their TSH will be elevated, but their T4, T3 will be decreased, right? So when a person has a myxedema coma, so how would you treat these people? Right? You want to give them like levothyroxine, basically just replace their thyroid hormone. But another thing you can also typically give these people is you also, again, give them hydrocortisone. I don't know if you're noticing a pattern here. In general, hydrocortisone is not a bad idea in a person that has a myxedema coma, right? So again, you give them hydrocortisone. If they have hyponatremia, you can, give them like normal saline, right? Try to avoid giving them like half normal saline. Give them like normal saline, right? And then again, you replace their thyroid hormone. For the most part, you give them like levothyroxine, like T4. But if the person is like super, super sick and they're like, circling the drain, you can give them T3, you can give them like liothyronine, liothyronine. Okay, you can give those people a liothyronine. So in general, for the most part, and you also give them fluids, right? You give them fluids, and if they're hypoglycemic, to the normal saline you're giving them, you need to go ahead and, add like D5. So just, again, key things to keep at the back of your mind. And then the last thing I think I will go ahead and talk about is just differentiating a Sheehan syndrome from a pituitary apoplexy. That's just something people seem to get wrong for whatever bizarre reason on MBME exams. So the thing is, Sheehan syndrome, right, the way it will present is, it'll be a woman that just delivered a kid and she has like failure to lactate after delivery. Sometimes she may be hype. And you may say, okay, what can precipitate this, right? Well, the thing is, I think of Sheehan syndrome as like an ischemic stroke of the pituitary, because think about it, right? When a woman is pregnant, you know, she produces all these hormones. Well, those hormones come from somewhere, right? Come from the anterior pituitary. So the anterior pituitary like undergoes like massive hypertrophy while a person is pregnant, right? So it's like very dependent on blood supply and also like very susceptible to like hypotension or a ton of blood loss. So those people, if they like infarct, like have like an ischemic injury, right? Like because like, oh, they have like birth and it's like bloody, they lose a ton of blood, then that can infarct the pituitary gland, right? So those people, you know, get into trouble, right? So like they'll have like signs and symptoms of pituitary insufficiency, right? So you know, they will not produce prolactin, so they will have problems lactating. They may have like an adrenal crisis because they're not making ACTH. They may be hypothyroid because they're not producing a TSH, right? So those are all things that can present on exams. And another, the classic test that you can use is very unusual, but you can do like the TRH stimulation test, right? So because typically if you give a person TRH, remember another name for TRH, like thyrotropin releasing hormone, is a prolactin releasing factor, right? So failure of a person's prolactin to rise with TRH augmentation is essentially diagnostic of a pituitary insufficiency on MBME exams, right? And then the difference between Sheehan syndrome and pituitary apoplexy. The person that's got pituitary apoplexy, the thing is, I think of it more as like, as against like the ischemic stroke of the pituitary that underlies Sheehan syndrome, pituitary apoplexy is more of like a hemorrhagic stroke of the pituitary, right? So I almost think of it as like a subarachnoid hemorrhage of the pituitary. So you may say, okay, Divine, how will this present on an exam, right? So these people will usually have like, you know, like sudden headache. They may have like visual field deficits. Because the thing is, these people, they are bleeding into their pituitary glands, right? So that increased pressure from the blood can compress the cavernous sinus. So they have like visual field deficits. Or you can also even compress like the optic chiasm, right? And then these people tend to have like adrenal insufficiency, other pituitary symptoms. So you may say, okay, what can cause this? Well, the thing that can cause this is if a person has like a existing like pituitary tumor, like an adenoma, for whatever reason, like pituitary adenomas bleed at like a rate like almost like fivefold more compared to other brain tumors, right? So these people can get into like serious trouble. So I mean, typically you treat like their signs and symptoms of like pituitary insufficiency, try to control their blood pressure if it's elevated, although usually these people are like hypotensive and stuff like that. For the most part, the management of pituitary apoplexy is probably not something you should expect to see on an MBME exam. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for a ton of exams. Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 2 CS, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, I tutor for the ABIM boards, the medicine in training exam. And then if you're, I do this thing called longitudinal tutoring, where if you're like a first, second, or third year med student, I tutor for like your block or shelf exams. But at the same time, I tutor for your upcoming USMLE exams. And then I do this like USMLE booster courses. It's like 10 hours for Step 2 CK and Step 3. Or 20 hours for Step 1. Again, if you're interested in that, just let me know and I'll be happy to point you in the right direction. I've kind of talked about it ad nauseum in other podcasts. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS app, I do offer like coaching for like, you know, the application process, like application editing, personal statements, mock interviews, rec letters. Again, I've been on the admissions committee of a top 2 med school for a year. I've worked with tons and tons of people that have applied through the ERAS process. Most of the people I worked with have matched their first choices. So again, I've been quite successful there. And then finally, if you have like a college student buddy that needs tutoring for like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, I do offer tutoring for all those things. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.